Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching never changed anything.
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week. 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out. He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarion Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarion can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
The only two things in life that make it worth living is guitars tuned good and firm feeling women. I don't need my name in the marquee lights. Got my song, got you with me tonight. Maybe it's time we got back to the basics of love. Let's go to Lukenbach, Texas, Waylon and Willie and the boys. This successful life we're living got us feuding like the Hatfields and McCoys. Between Hank Williams' pain songs and Lou Berry's train songs and blue eyes crying in the rain. Out in Lukenbach, Texas, ain't nobody feeling no pain. So baby, let's sell your diamond ring, buy some boots and faded jeans and go away. This coat and tie is choking me, and in your high society you cry all day. We've been so busy keeping up with the Joneses, four-car garage, and we're still building on. Maybe in time we got back to the basics of love. Let's go to Lukenbach, Texas. Waylon and Willie and the boys. This successful life we're living got us feuding like the Hatfields and McCoys. Between Hank Williams' pain songs and Newberry's train songs and blue eyes crying in the rain. Out in Lukenbach, Texas, ain't nobody feeling no pain. Let's go to Lukenbach, Texas, William Waylon and boy. This successful life we're living's got us feuding like the Hatfields and the Coys. Between the Hank Williams pain song, Jerry Jeff train songs and blue eyes crying in the rain. Out in Lukenbach, Texas, there ain't nobody feeling no pain. The only two things in life that make it worth living is guitars tuned good and firm feeling women. I don't need my name in the marquee lights. I got my song and I got you with me tonight. Maybe it's time we got back to the basics of love. Let's go to Lukenbach, Texas, Waylon and Willie and the boys. This successful life we're living got us feuding like the Hatfields and McCoys. Between Hank Williams' pain songs and Lou Berry's train songs and blue eyes crying in the rain. Out in Lukenbach, Texas, ain't nobody feeling no pain. So baby, let's sell your diamond ring, buy some boots and faded jeans and go away. This coat and tie is choking me, and in your high society you cry all day. We've been so busy keeping up with the Joneses, four-car garage, and we're still building on. Maybe in time we got back to the basics of love. Let's go to Lukenbach, Texas, Waylon and Willie and the boys. This successful life we're living got us feuding like the Hatfields and McCoys. Between Hank Williams' pain songs and Newberry's train songs and blue eyes crying in the rain. Out in Lukenbach, Texas, ain't nobody feeling no pain. Let's go to Lukenbach, Texas, William Waylon and boy. This successful life we're living's got us feuding like the Hatfields and the boys. Between the Hank Williams Payne song and Jerry Jeff train song, eyes crying in the rain. Out in Lukenbach, Texas, there ain't nobody feeling no pain.
What's up, folks? I don't usually go live, but I was reading a story tonight, and I found it fascinating. So, as typical, I'm, you know, debating some stuff on Facebook, and some things were brought up about, you know, black history and, you know, wealth in America back in the 1800s, 1900s, and the wealth gap and things like that. So, you know, I started going back, doing some research so I can be a little more informed, just to gather some more information. So I run across the story of this guy, Lunsford Lane. He was born in what I'm reading from here is the biography of Lunsford Lane, 30th of May, 1803 to 1863. They don't know his exact date of death. It's written by Alice R. Cotton. There's several works about Lunsford Lane, though. And I just found it interesting. Like, it really feels like this guy should have a movie made about him, because it literally goes through the gambit of being a slave to being free to experiencing, you know, extreme hate and physical harm to being free to being a businessman. Like, this dude was it, like, living the dream, you know, and then things come crashing down. So I started to write a post about it, and I said it's not going to do it justice. Like, I need to do a video. So this is basically the story of Lunsford Lane. I'm not going to read it word for word. I'm going to kind of commentate over it. So Lunsford Lane, as I said, was born May 30th, 1803. He was born into slavery, and he was the a slave of Sherwood Haywood. Sherwood Haywood, you know, was an older gentleman, and later on, Lunsford ended up being the slave of his wife, because after he died, the wife assumed him and she had to make some money. So she had to use him throughout, or use him to make some money. So all right, this is what happened. So he was a house slave, which gave him certain benefits, you know. What he would do is actually, he would go, let me back up, actually. He had a basket of peaches from his dad, and he sold the basket of peaches. And when he sold them, it was like, wait a minute. Profit. So he was able to profit from that basket of peaches from his father. And that started him into these business venture ideas. So what he did was he started trying to earn money for freedom, because at the time he wanted his freedom, obviously. And so he saved whatever he could from that. He also got tips from people who were guests of the Haywood family. He cut wood during his spare time and at night. And then he and his father, now mind you, he's still a slave. He and his father started making and selling tobacco pipes. They were special smoking tobacco pipes. And he also often sold them to state legislators. Like, let that rattle around in your brain. This is North Carolina. Chapel Hill, North Carolina, is where this is coming out of. This is a local paper that is writing about the history of North Carolina. And they're saying that the legislators who were not giving this man his freedom were actually buying tobacco pipes from a slave. Like, that's crazy. Like, he's not good enough to be free, but they will buy your pipes. Anyway, all right, so what he would do is he would make these runs to buy supplies for the house. So he was buying food and things like that for the Haywood family, you know, just normal stuff, shopping runs. And he realized that he could buy things in bulk when the prices were lower, and he'd save a lot of money. So he took it from, all right, I'm going to buy things in bulk for the family, to, wait a minute, I got a few dollars, I'm going to buy a few things. So what he would do is buy stuff for the family, and then he'd buy stuff for himself as well. But that business mind was there. He was a straight-up entrepreneur, because what he would do was, let's say, buy, you know, whatever, apples, whatever, or something that didn't expire. And he would take those things and wait till the price rose. When the price would go up, he would resell it and make a profit. Now, this is a slave dude. Like, this dude was a slave, and he was a straight-up entrepreneur. He's fascinating. So that was just more of his, you know, entrepreneurial spirit coming about. So all these little things he was trying to do to make money and to become a free man. So he ended up getting married. The lady was a slave to another family, the Boylan family. And she ended up being bought by this guy, Benjamin B. Smith. He was a merchant in Raleigh. And so this is around the time that Sherwood Haywood died in 1829. This is his wife then started having to utilize the slaves to make money to pay off some debts and things like that. At the time, Lunsford expanded his tobacco business. He called it Edward Lunsford and Lane. And he had agents in Fayetteville, Salisbury, and Chapel Hill. Think about that. Lunsford Lane. He was a slave who had a tobacco business, and he had agents in Fayetteville, Salisbury, and Chapel Hill, North Carolina. This is 1828. This dude was doing business as a slave. These are some things that, you know, the narrative doesn't teach us. You know, we don't hear about these sort of stories. So Mrs. Haywood decided that he could buy his freedom for $1,000. Now, let's put that into perspective. $1,000 in 1835, that's $26,445.91 today. So let that sink in. The dude made enough money to buy his freedom for $26,445.91 in today's currency. Yeah, Mr. Dale, it's Sherwood Haywood was a slave owner, and Lunsford Lane is the was the slave. So he bought his freedom, and when he bought it, North Carolina legislator, mind you, he was selling tobacco products to these dudes, they wouldn't authorize his manumission. which manumission is the same as emancipation, except it happens from a slave owner. So emancipation is from a government, manumission is from the slave owner. So they wouldn't allow it because he couldn't prove meritorious service, which means he couldn't prove that he was deserving of a reward or praise. So, you know, weird law that they put into place to block it. So what he did was he went to his wife's owner, Mr. Smith, Benjamin B. Smith, and had him buy him and took him to New York. When he went to New York, he received his manumission papers. So now he's free. So he's a free man in New York, but all his people, his family's back in North Carolina. So, of course, what does he do? He tries to go back to North Carolina to buy his wife and children and get them out. And what he ended up doing was buying them for $2,500. In today's money, that's $66,114.78. Let that register. This dude was free in 1835, and he went back to buy his family for $66,000. He had just bought himself for $26,000. Think about that kind of money at that time for a slave. Let that register. This dude is becoming my hero the more I read about him. So anyway, he did it in installments, but they allowed them to live in a house that they built there in Raleigh. So he didn't go back to New York. He stayed in Raleigh. So he had the tobacco and the firewood business because he was still cutting wood. And he worked as a messenger and a handyman for the governor. So this is where trouble comes in. So he was a slave, then he becomes free, and then he starts amassing a little bit of wealth. So 5 years later, in 1840, he was notified that because he was emancipated in New York, that is in violation of state law, and that free blacks from other states weren't allowed to enter North Carolina. Like, it was a law that if you were free somewhere else, you could not come to the state. The whole state was banned to free blacks. That's a little mind-boggling, but that was the law at the time. So they gave him 20 days to leave. So he received a bunch of support from a bunch of influential whites. And this is another part of the narrative that isn't told too often, is that not all white people were evil or, you know, angry with black people. Some of them did try to help. And in this case, these influential whites tried to bid for him to stay in North Carolina. But in 1841, he was forced to go. And so they had given him 20 days. This was in September, so he made it to May of 1841, and they made him leave. And so he was taking one of his children. He took one of his children and went to New York and also to Boston. And he raised money by lecturing in churches and abolitionist meetings. So after this, of course, you know, in his typical fashion, a year later, almost a year later, April of 1842, he returned to Raleigh to try to get the rest of his family. He had talked to the governor before he went there, and the governor was like, the law is the law. I can't really do anything about it, but I'm, you know, pretty sure you'll be okay. Like, go ahead and come anyway. And so he makes his way back to Raleigh, and he gets arrested. They charged him with delivering abolitionist letters and tried him at call court. Now, there was no proof about it, so the mayor let it go, and they released him. When they released him, a mob abducted him. They dragged him to the gallows, and they tarred and feathered him. It wasn't only from the help of his white friends that smuggled him out overnight, and his wife, children, and his mother. This was one of the Mrs. Haywood, the original slave owner of his, helped him catch a train to Philadelphia. 2 years later, his father was freed from the Haywood family as well. They ended up living in Philadelphia, New York, Boston, Worcester, Oberlin, Ohio. He continued to lecture, and again, they don't know what year he actually died, but he died around that time. So, like, summing up the story, Like, that was just fascinating to me to hear that he made so much money that he was able to spend in that time money, $3,500, to free himself and his family. And then once he gets his freedom, goes back, and he ends up getting tarred and feathered. I'm sure he got beaten as well during that time. And he has a biography out. It's called Lunsford Lane. And part of his biography, he states that he thought it was a good escape. And, like, the mindset of that, like, okay, I just had a good escape. He had a good escape because he got tarred and feathered and he didn't get hung. Like, that was his mindset. Like, I escaped. I didn't get tarred and feathered. I mean, I didn't get hung. I was only tarred and feathered. The mental mindset of this dude during a time that is unfathomable in a state that wouldn't allow free blacks to live is something that needs to permeate in this country right now across everybody. It's not just a black thing. Facing that much adversity, being a slave, becoming an entrepreneur while in slavery, being an entrepreneur outside of slavery, making money state to state to state that he went and amassing enough money to buy his freedom. What's your excuse? Like, literally, what excuse do you have right now not to get out there and do equal or more than what Lunsford Lane did? He's fascinating. Anyway, thought I would share it. There's plenty of information out there. There's a book by Richard Bardolph called The Negro Vanguard. There's Anti-Slavery Leaders in North Carolina by John Spencer Bassett. John Hope Franklin, The Free Negro of North Carolina. There's plenty of stuff out here where you can find out about it. There's also Lunsford Lane's own biography, which is called The Narrative of Lunsford Lane, formerly of North Carolina, or Raleigh, North Carolina. There was a second edition published in 1842. I'm going to keep reading about him because I haven't read his own personal words. I skimmed over some of his stuff. This was more of a short version of it. But you should definitely, definitely read up on this guy. Use it as the inspiration that you need in order to get out in this world, make a change, make a difference. So, Lunsford Lane, I'm out.
All right. Hadn't played that one in quite a while, Lunsford Lane. And fascinating story. He, I guess you can get it on, hopefully, Amazon Kindle, his narrative. I don't know why they call it narrative. Man, that was his book. The man was he was an author. Okay, self-published author. Anyway, amazing story. Now, and he did that with no internet connection, no smartphone, no tablet, no desktop, no laptop. So I agree with the guy who read that that was speaking. No excuses. Anyway, okay. Yesterday we started something. Officially started something where every day that we do a live podcast, which is typically Monday through Friday, we're going to feature, which is 20 a month, bare minimum, we're going to feature a tiny town. All right. And here's how I define a tiny town. All right. You've heard me talk about tiny houses a lot, but the easiest place to put tiny houses are in tiny towns. But anyway, that's a different subject. Anyway, so my definition of a tiny town is a town that has a population of no more than 100 people. No more than 100 people. And or, it doesn't have to be both, but and or, a town that has no more than 100 acres. All right? A tiny town to me is a town that has absolutely no more than 100 people and no more than 100 acres. All right? Now, yesterday, number one, and I'm numbering one, and we're putting that on the live stream, so because we archive all these programs, it'll be easier to follow. You know, if you want to pick out one or two, you can just put it in the town or Tiny Town 1, and it'll pop up. So yesterday we officially started Luckenbach, Texas. Was the first highlight we did. And Luckenbach, once again, just as a quick review, is only on 10 acres of land. The town is 10 acres big, and it has a population of 3 people. And they've been around for over 100 years, I believe. And the thing is, with Luckenbach, the town generates revenue because they have weekend events. They have an online store, accommodations, I said online stores, but they have T-shirts. You can get it. You know, look. Let's go to LuckenbachTexas.com. That's their website, and you can see they got a few items on there. So they got a website. They have weekend events. You can also rent the whole town. You got a shindig that you might need, you know, 5 or 10 acres. You know, you can rent the town. They make money that way. Weddings, you know, receptions. And you can find out more by simply going to their website and contacting them. And if you're in Texas, in that part of Texas, drop by Luckenbach, Texas. So anyway, so they fit our definition. And they built their, well, the town had a population of way more than 3 people when it, you know, may not during its history. But it, and so read up on it if you want. So they were number one. Now, number two, we're going to highlight the town of Sibley, North Dakota. Sibley, North Dakota. So this is tiny town number two that we're featuring. And it has a population of 20 people. And it's a town that is, the size of it is 30 acres. It's 30 acres big. So once again, an acre is the size of a football field thereabouts. So imagine 30 football fields. That's the size of Sibley, Texas. Excuse me, Sibley, North Dakota. And Sibley, North Dakota, now this is the moniker I'm putting on it, and I'm going to read you the backstory on Sibley, North Dakota here shortly. But I call it the town that was built around a burger stand. That's one of the reasons why I'm featuring these little small, because, like I say, even Houston, Texas, with over 2 million people, Houston started off with two brothers. That's how Houston started up, from 2 people to 2 million. And they didn't live long enough to see the 2 million, the two brothers. But if they got some generational wealth going, if they got a bloodline still live, I mean, you know what? And here's how I'm looking at life now. When it comes to where you live, just imagine, let's get a visual of a table. On one side of the table, you either live in the city as a consumer. On the other side of the table, you own the town. Which side do you want to sit on? Which side of the table do you want to sit on? And Luckenbach, they sit on the owner's side of the table. They own the town. All right, so Sibley, let's see, let's go to, Sibley, North Dakota. All right, Sibley is a city in Barnes County, North Dakota. Population was 19 at the 2020 census. Sibley was founded in 1959. I'm older than Sibley. Okay. All right. Let's get some more info on this. It's like I said, this is big. You know, we have to look up the dates of the civil rights era right after this too. All right. Let's get the history of Sibley, North Dakota. Sibley was created by. And let's get our American flags out and wave them. Sibley was created by Eddie and Edith Hoagland beginning in 1954 when they observed the popularity of the nearby, of the lake nearby and decided that a hamburger restaurant would be profitable. Therefore, they purchased some land near the lake and began to erect buildings, a dance hall, the restaurant, the burger joint, and many others. This is a husband and wife team, okay? The city was incorporated as a dispute with authorities of Sibley Trail Township, which has a separate page on Wikipedia. Although the Hoaglands wanted a liquor license, the township authorities would not grant one. Once again, let's get the visual here of a table. If you're living in the town, on one side of the table, as a citizen, and citizens consume. A lot of citizens don't produce anything. They consume. Or you're going to sit on the other side of the table and all. So since they couldn't get the liquor license, the township authorities would not grant wood, so the Hoaglands incorporated the city where they bought land, I mean the town, the settlement where they bought land. It was named after Henry Hastings Sibley, a general and the first governor of Minnesota. Let's see. In the 1970s, the Hoaglands sold the majority of the city to others, keeping the core businesses. They retained the business core of the city for many years, even after Eddie's death in 2007. Edith announced the upcoming sale of the remaining parts at a city auction. Well, I'm going to see if Edith is, if she's still around, but what a fascinating story. 19 or 20 people live in Sibley, North Dakota, a town that was basically built around a hamburger stand. 3 acres. Now, let's get the dates of the civil rights era here. Let's see, civil rights. Era. Let's go with the timeline here. All right, the civil rights era began in the late 1940s and ended in the late 1960s. All right, and the civil rights era was very, it opened up a lot of doors and whatnot. Now, I'm reading one timeline here that says Civil Rights Timeline 1865 to 1968. And if we go back to 1865 as the timeline, as the start of the timeline for the Civil Rights era, there was a movement that a lot of people don't talk about. It was called the Black Towns Movement, or maybe back then it was called the Negro Towns Movement. And that's where people like Pap Singleton, who was a former slave, now free, and under the encouragement and direction of Booker T. Washington, a number of black folks, matter of fact, they were at its peak. 1,400 black townships were founded by primarily former slaves. They were also called freedom villages, or excuse me, not freedom villages, freedmen's villages. And I would say that's a big, that was, I would say, probably the most productive part of the civil rights era that people really don't even know about. Typically, a lot of people start with, you know, the 50s, and they go with Martin Luther King and, you know, the march and the protesting in Montgomery, Alabama, and sitting in at lunch counters. And all that's important. I'm not discounting that. But I'm saying way before that, you had the Black Towns Movement, or they could have been called the Negro Towns Movement. Or let's put it, the Freedmen's Town Movement. And we had a historian on here, Professor Rhonda Rags, though. She hasn't been on in a while. But she was on here at least three or four times that gave us a lot of backstory and information on the history of black townships, as she would call it. Freedmen's Town, not Freedom Towns, but Freedmen's Towns. And I've visited some like Taft, Oklahoma, Tallahassee, Oklahoma, Summit, Oklahoma, Eatonville, Florida, 45 minutes away from me. Up in Maryland, you have Fairmont Heights, Maryland, North Brentwood, Maryland, Highland Beach, Maryland, Anne Arundel County, Maryland. All those are freedmen's towns or black towns. Take your pick. All right. So now there's probably anywhere from 800 to maybe 1,000, but at its peak, around about 1,400 of them. And they're now, like, what do you call it? Oklahoma claims 13 to 15, but those are, they come in two flavors. They're municipal townships. You know, they have a corporate charter and all that, and they can elect their own mayor and city council and all that, and tax their citizens and have municipal services. And then there's unincorporated communities or little towns, like Black Jack, Oklahoma. You won't find it online. I haven't found it online yet. And I've been in Black Jack at least five times. It's literally sandwiched right next door to Taft, Oklahoma. I can find Taft online, but I can't find Blackjack online, but it's real. Okay. So, and one of the wealthiest black people, particularly when she was a young girl, she's buried there. That's Sarah Rector. Sarah Rector. Now, Sarah Rector's childhood home, which every time I'm in Taft, I pass by and see it, and somebody's still living in it. That's in Taft, Oklahoma. And Taft has its own graveyard. But Sarah is buried, and I haven't been, although I've been in, Black Jack, Oklahoma, but at the every time I went there, I did not know that Sarah Rector, she's buried in Black Jack, Oklahoma's, graveyard. So they have their own graveyard churches and all that. And I'm saying all that to say this. There's a lot of communities in the United States that exist, but you're not going to find them on the Internet. But they do exist. So and most of them are rural, so you got to go out there and check them out. Okay, so anyway, now, so with the Civil Rights era, I like the black towns or the freedmen's town or freedmen's villages era of the civil rights, because that goes back to 1865, okay, where former slaves were building their own houses debt-free. They were taking care of each other within the town through social capital. The skill set of people was higher then. Their grocery stores were their backyards or, you know, the neighbors or what have you. And for the first 50 or 60 years, it was great. Now, there was a disconnect, in my opinion, I just have an opinion, that, you know, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt came to office, and then we got these entitlement programs, which white folks participated in too. But a lot of people just, I think too many people just got caught up with that. And then the story of the freedmen's towns and the entrepreneur, like the Jim Crow, when people speak of the Jim Crow era, they speak a lot of negativity, and it was negativity and laws set up and all that. But at the same time, during the Jim Crow era, and I at least 3-4 times a year, I do a feature called Jim Crow Millionaires. You had a prolific amount of black folk that got rich during the Jim Crow era. But people don't, you know, most of the times when you hear a Jim Crow story, it's coming from a victim point of view. But I look at it as, when I look at the Jim Crow era, I'm looking at who got rich. What black person got rich during the Jim Crow era? And there were plenty of them. And we have them in our archives. Let's look up Jim Crow millionaires and something will pop up. And that's the coin, a term I coined. But anyway, all right, so getting back to Sibley, North Dakota, all right, which is not a black township, but it was a town where a husband and wife team noticed that, you know, hey, these people over here at this beach, and, you know, there's no, you know, unless they bring their food with them, you know, there's no place to eat. And they've got money. If they're out here by the lake, they've got money. So, hey, just set up a burger stand. And they built the town of Sibley, North Dakota, which stands to this day. Population of 20. It's a tiny town. More than likely, Edith the wife. I'm just speculating. It could have been a husband. Could have been both of them. They were up there cooking the burgers. And and from that, they got the idea, you know what? Well, let's put a dance hall up here. All right. Now, this happened during the Civil Rights era. So I know, and I'm going to have to do some homework on it because I got the dates now. I know there was some black entrepreneurs during the Civil Rights era where they didn't march, and there's nothing wrong with marching, you know, but they didn't march, they didn't protest. I'm sure there was some black townships that probably were set up, and this was their way of, you know, getting near do with civil rights. They went to a place, and let's get back to that table again. On one side, and let's call the table, I want you to get a good visualist. Let's sit down like a breakfast table. Let's say a round table. Or if you have a vision for a boardroom table, let's, you know, on one side of it, you can't sit at both sides of them now. You got to pick one side of the table up. On one side of the civil rights table, okay, you want somebody else to give you a job. You want the government to provide for you, you know, medical, government cheese, food stamps, whatever you want to get out the government. On that side of the table, you want reparations, okay? And remember, there are 31 flavors of reparations. So there are over 31 flavors, so you pick, nobody's wrong, pick whatever you're happy with. Okay, so that's on one, and Martin Luther King is on that side of the table, of the civil rights table. So is Medgar Evers, so is Jesse Jackson, so is Al Sharpton. All those guys on that side of the civil rights table. Now, on the other civil rights, or on the other side of the civil rights table, okay, we have people like the Englands. They were white, but they were exercising their civil right to start their own town. Now, on the other side of the civil rights table, where we got Martin Luther King and Jesse Jackson and all those people, and people that want stuff from the government, including reparations from whatever government, local, state, or federal, on that side of the table, okay, there might be even fighting for, housing. That was a big one. That's a big one. All right. They want local, state, and federal government to do something for them. This thing called redlining. These are all civil rights issues on that side of the civil rights table. But on the other side of the civil rights table, okay, we have people like Dempsey Travis, or either Travis Dempsey, black man in Chicago. He has his own real estate company. We have people like John H. Johnson, who started Ebony and Jet magazine with the original publication. He's on that side of the civil rights table. You know, we have black folk that started their own townships, like Mother Baltimore, born a slave, black woman, was enslaved in Missouri, bought her freedom just like England did, and went over to Missouri with some other families, and they started a town. Brooklyn, Illinois, which was a freedom village. That's how it started. Okay, they were on that side of the civil rights table. So we have owners and producers on one side of the table, and we have consumers and beggars on the other side of the table. That's the civil rights table. And that's why I named Lunsford. We started at the beginning of the podcast. Lunsford was on the production side of the table. And his, once again, there are over 31 flavors of reparations, okay? That's why I call it Baskin-Robbins education. I mean, reparations. He decided his form of reparations was to buy his freedom and to buy that freedom. And you saw the cut. Audio was done a few years ago. But in 21st century dollars or 20th century dollars, you heard what the guy was saying, like $60,000 per person. No internet connection. No smartphone. No government program. And no excuses. So we're going to bring up the civil rights table quite often from here on out because I think people need to take a look at it. Matter of fact, let's get the definition. Civil rights. What's the definition of that? Okay, let's see. Okay, the definition here, civil rights is a noun. The rights of citizens to political, social, freedom, and equality. All right. That's the definition I have here. Okay. What are civil rights? I'm reading from another path. Civil rights are the essential component of a democracy. They're guarantees of equal social opportunities and protection under the law, regardless of race, religion, and other characteristics. Okay, examples are the right to vote, the right to a fair trial, the right to government services, the right to a public education. In contrast, the civil liberties which are freedoms secured by placing restraints on government. Civil rights are secured by positive government action, often in the form of legislation. Okay, well, there are 24 hours in this day. That's equal for everybody. Now, the Lunsford, now they're white, but let me use some black examples, although we're not highlighting them today, but we have highlighted them in the past. Laura Douglas, the daughter-in-law of Frederick Douglass, and I forgot her husband's name at the moment, Frederick Douglass's son, they were turned away. This is before Jesse Jackson was born, before there was an NAACP and all that. They were turned away from a hotel because they were black. So they didn't march or protest. Now, they had a civil right to do that, though, if they wanted to. But they didn't do that. They exercised the civil right of, well, they're 24 hours in the day. And since they're 24 hours a day, and then there's land out here to buy, they went to Anne Arundel County, Maryland, and they bought 40 or 50 acres of land, and they started their own town called Highland Beach, Maryland. See, on one side of the table, you know, where they went into a hotel as a consumer, they were turned away legally. So they decided to go to the other side of the civil rights table and say, you know what, part of this whole civil rights thing is you need to think big. I think a lot of people, they don't think big enough. They went on the other side of the civil rights table. They bought 40 or 50. They didn't wait for the government to give them 40 acres of land now. They didn't cry over spilled milk over that. They said, you know what, I'm going to exercise my civil rights in this capitalistic society, and we're going to buy 40 or 50 acres of land, and then we're going to start our own town. Look it up right now, Highland Beach, Maryland. Matter of fact, since I'm talking about it, let me go, for those who can't get to their computer or whatever, Highland Beach, wait a minute. Yeah, Highland Beach, Maryland. Okay, Highland Beach is a town in Anne Arundel County, Maryland. As of the 2020 census, has a population of 118 people. It qualifies as my tiny town. Okay, the town was founded in the late 19th century by an affluent African Americans from Washington, D.C. and Baltimore looking for a summer retreat on the Chesapeake Bay. The town was incorporated, the town's incorporated status gave it a unique standing in empowering it to maintain its own police force. If you don't like the police force, wear out people, start your own town where you pick the police, and you're the police chief. But anyway, and we're going to show people how to do that throughout the year. That's why we're doing one of these today. All right, the town, celebrities with homes there have included historian Alex Haley, author comedian Bill Cosby, Arthur Ashe. Street names in the town include Crummel, Dunbar, Henson, Augusta, Douglas, Langston, and Washington, which were chosen to honor leading African Americans. Okay, once again, it has a population of 118 people. I think it's about 50 acres large now. History, let's get to the history. Highland Beach, Maryland was founded in the summer of 1893 by Major Charles Redmond Douglas, Frederick Douglass's son, and his wife, Laura, after they had been turned away from a restaurant by a nearby Bay Ridge resort because of their race. Charles Douglass, a retired military officer who served in the 54th Massachusetts Infantry Regiment of the United States Colored Troops during the American Civil War, after being turned away, Major Douglass decided to buy beachfront property directly south of the Bay Bridge and sell lots to family and friends. That is a demonstration of exercising your civil rights. Now, once again, we're looking at the civil rights table now. On the left side of the table, he and his wife got shit on. But he didn't march, he didn't protest, he didn't complain. You know, he didn't go on a fast. He just went on the right side of the civil rights table. And he and his wife bought 40 or 50 acres of land, and they started their own town. That is civil rights in action. And I also call it do-it-yourself reparations. All right, so Major Douglass bought a 40-acre tract with 500 feet of beachfront on the Chesapeake Bay from Daniel Brashears, a black farmer and a waterman in Anne Arundel County, and turned it into a summer enclave. All right, he built two homes built, one for himself and his wife and their children, and one as a retirement home for his father, Frederick Douglass, who was known as, which was known as Twin Oaks. Frederick Douglass's house is now called the Douglass Summer House, which is listed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1992. It became a regular gathering place for upper-class African-Americans. Robert Terrell, the first black municipal court judge in Washington, D.C., and his wife, activist and civil rights leader Mary Church Terrell, built a home named Villa Aloha in 1915 on the property they purchased in 1893, which was next door to the Douglass Summer House. Their grandson, Raymond L. Langston, former Highland Beach mayor, owns his home. That's generational wealth. Among the residents and guests in the town were Paul Robeson, Robert Weaver, Harriet, W.E.B. Du Bois, the poets Langston Hughes and Paul Lawrence Dunbar. Frederick Douglass visited and would have become a resident, but he died in 1895, before the house that his son was building for him was completed. In the early 1900s, a horse stable, a guest house, and a hotel and tennis courts were all built in the community to accommodate the growing number of residents and their guests. This man and his wife, I'm just thinking about the 40 acres. Because we got people in 2023 whining over we didn't get our 40 acres. Once these, I got to keep saying it. Which side of the civil rights table are you going to sit on? You can't sit on both sides at the same time. You got to pick. He took 40 acres, and I think he eventually bought 10 more. He bought 40 acres and monetized it. He sold lots of people that wanted to have a house there, their own beach house there, live there full time. Services that you probably couldn't get, and, you know, wherever these people were coming from, they had it there. Let's see, the guest house, which was built by George Bowen in 1902, was a very popular site for lectures, discussions, and informal gatherings. So they probably rented out, you know, the rooms for that. the hotel, they put a hotel there, which was built by Richard Francis Weir in the 1920s, was a popular spot for Saturday night dances and a meeting place for church groups. It was converted into a private home in the 1970s. After the death of Charles R. Douglas in 1920, his son, Haley G. Douglas, took over the development of the area. Haley Douglas became a member of the Board of Commissioners in the town of Highland Beach and incorporated the town on May 12, 1922, making it Maryland's first African-American municipality in Maryland. He and his friends controlled the community for the next 30 years, keeping it small and exclusive. He served as mayor. Isn't that something? Talk about generational wealth. Frederick Douglass and his wife left a whole town. Well, see, that's part of their civil rights. We got to start thinking bigger. And he left his son the mayorship. Okay, so let's see. In 1922, Osborne T. Taylor, Highland Beach president, bought 13 acres south of Highland Beach and created Venice Beach, which still, so see, that's what I mean. Now, I've been to Highland Beach about two or three times, but I didn't know about Venice Beach. And Venice Beach, Maryland, still exists. So next time I'm up in that neighborhood, I got to check it out. Okay, in 1929, the 1950 edition of the Cumberland Evening Times census, all right, Highland Beach had a population of 45 homes. Highland Beach was described as a 44-acre retreat with 52 glad poured shingle and stucco cottages that date back to 1894. Okay, 1,000 feet of waterfront where no pets and picnicking are allowed. See, these people set their own rules. Anyway, folks, just put in Highland Beach, Maryland, if you want to know more about that. Let me see now. Venice Beach. Let's see if they have an article on Venice Beach, Maryland. I don't want Venice Beach, Florida. Venice Beach. They say some of these towns are not listed. You can't find them online unless they have. All right, Venice Beach, Maryland, they do have info on it. Do they have a Wikipedia on it? They have an all right, well, let's see. Venice Beach. Venice Beach is another African-American beach area that came into being soon after Highland Beach was settled in 1922. This is a very small community of 60 homes on Oyster Creek and the Chesapeake Bay. Okay. All right. Well, I got to add this to my list. Let me see, Venice Beach, Maryland. When I started this podcast this morning, I did not know it existed. Okay, Venice Beach, Maryland. Okay. All right. All right. As I find out more information, I'll include in that. So like I said, we're featuring these one a day. All right. So our main one today was Sibley, North Dakota. But when I thought of the civil rights table, because in a lot of situations, if you're not getting civil rights or the civil rights you deserve in one area, then it's up to you to create a situation or an environment where you get your civil rights. And that's what the Douglas family did with Highland Beach. You know, well, if you're not going to give it to me at this geographical location, at this particular resort or hotel, then I'm going to go to a place where I can invent my own. And they did that. And then somebody else to do their own. All right, so that's why with the Tiny Town I'm featuring this, because I looked at my own resources. So my primary business now is basically I'm in the township business. They're little tiny towns, but once again, Luckenbach, Texas, 10 acres. All right. I found townships so far, municipal townships, as small as 5 acres so far. I know they have one smaller, probably as small as 1 acre, but the smallest municipal one I've been able to find so far. But I've just been doing this for like a week and a half, 2 weeks research on it. But Luckenbach, you know, is just 10. So in any event, that's the feature for today. Tomorrow, we'll feature another tiny town. But today, our hats off salutes to Sibley, North Dakota, town that was built around a burger stand. If I had an American, I'm going to have to go get me an American flag. You can't. Even with the Frederick Douglass, Douglass's son. Man, let's get out the American flag on that one and wave. You know, so, matter of fact, tomorrow, we'll revisit the civil rights table later. Okay. All right, so that's my rant for today. So you've got people out there. You can start your own town, because when you start your own town, you're clearly sitting on the right side of the civil rights table. Once again, you're gonna pick what side you're gonna be on. I'm on the right side of the civil rights table. Okay, area code 410. Your mic is open.
Hotel, Brother L.A., how you doing this morning?
Fine, particularly since I'm on the right side of the civil rights table.
How big the difference? You on both sides of the civil rights.
It depends on how you look at it.
No, you're on both sides, regardless of how you look at it. But look, let me go back to where you started with the black towns. I think years back I sent you a list of over 3,000 black created towns. And I don't know if you had a white lady on your program or not. She has compiled a list.
We did some years ago, Rhonda Ragsdale. And she her specialization, at least one of them, are black townships. So she's on at least 3 or 4 podcasts and they're talking about black townships.
Yeah, and there used to be a website, what was it, Soul of America or something like that, where
America, I don't know if that's still up. Soul of America, then it was a black townships website. I don't know if that's still online. But a lot of those towns Matter of fact, if you look up Freedmen's Villages, you'll see a list, and then there were quite a few in the state of Texas, and that site's still alive. Once you know, you can start. You find out, like Maryland, Venice Beach, Maryland. I didn't realize it was a Venice Beach, and because I've been to Highland Beach two or three times, but I didn't realize, until I read this thing this morning, that Venice Beach, Maryland was a black township. I never even heard of it.
Yeah, have you heard of Dundalk, Maryland?
Plenty of times.
Well, just adjacent or either some miles from Dundalk. Right, but there was a famous black doctor that created a black beach in that area. And that's where all of the blacks used to go from Annapolis and Baltimore to that beach. Now, I've been in that area. I don't know if it still exists.
You sure wasn't
the guy
who started it wasn't the guy who started Venice Beach, Maryland?
It all depends on where Venice Beach, Maryland is. Is it over by Dundalk or over by Baltimore?
Let me look it up right now. Let's see. Venice Beach. Beach, Maryland. Okay. Venice Beach is an area code 21403. It says here, Anne Arundel on the Bay Road. Where would you say it would be?
It was over off by Dundalk, Maryland. I'll get you the name. I should have already had it.
All right, Dundalk,
Maryland.
All right. It's Venice Beach, Maryland to Dundalk, Maryland. It's a distance of 34.5 miles distance and a 42-minute drive between Dundalk and Venice Beach.
It's between Dundalk and Venice Beach?
You got to go through Glen Burnie and everything. Yeah, yeah.
That's probably it.
Dundalk to Venice Beach is a difference of 34 miles. And if you go from Dundalk to Venice Beach, you got to go through Glen Burnie. Then you got to go through Annapolis, and then you end up on the Chesapeake Bay to be the Venice Beach.
Yeah. It's probably the same beach, but I do know that a doctor and his wife created that beach. I did go in that area. Somebody was telling me about it when I was living there. The thing is,
they got the Venice Beach Citizens Association. Let me see. It's got to have the history here. Anyway, continue. I'm listening to you.
Yeah. All I was saying was that back in that day, black folks were self-reliant. And the thing is, we're virtually self-reliant now because nobody gives black folks anything. If we get it, we got to get it from our own efforts. And the key thing is, that's why it pisses me off when people say that black folks are always looking for a handout. We've always strived to do whatever it took to survive in this nation. Now, the thing is this, a lot of people don't appreciate it because a lot of people are not familiar with black history. You said something that Roosevelt created entitlement programs. Well, he did. But those entitlement programs weren't for black folk. If you read the information surrounding the New Deal, black folks were not involved. Black folks were barred from even taking part in the New Deal. Very few got into it. If you read it and you read how it was started and how the votes came in, the Southerners said, hey, we won't pass it if it means niggas are going to get part of it. And he had to spring a deal with the Southern Dixocrats, which was Democrats back in that day, to fashion that new deal so that black folks would be excluded. Now, you can look it up if you want to. But the thing is, when I tell you something, I can back it up. And the thing is, now, this welfare cheese and all of that stuff you discussed, that weren't for black folk. That was for white folk. But now we were able to get some crumbs like we always do. You know, they're created for white folks, and we, some of us are able to get some of the leftovers or some of the crumbs from those deals. But I sent you some years back showing you that before, when the Depression started, white folks started raiding cities and going in and looting stores and everything else. They call them food riots. And the thing is, I guess you didn't read it, but they knew they had to do something. In fact, the main reason why they did that New Deal was because a whole bunch of white folks had started marching on Washington. Now, we already always criticize about us marching for rights and justice, but this whole thing was started by white folks, and I sent you information on that, too. Now, I don't know whether you read it or not, but when they went in and they sent the army in to move those white folks off the Washington Mall, and they pushed down tents and everything else and hurt a bunch of white folks, they knew they had to do something. In fact, they sent an army general in to displace those people violently, tanks and everything else. But I guess you didn't read that part. But the thing is, Maya Angelou said the Depression had been going on for 10 years before black folks even knew it was a depression. Because the thing is, black folks, most of the population was in the South, and we survived on subsistence farming. And those people in the cities, most of the time, like, what is his name? Father Divine and all of them. And what's that congressman's name?
He wasn't hurting. Wasn't Sweet Daddy Grace back then also?
Sweet Daddy Grace, Father Divine, and Clayton Powell's daddy in Harlem.
Oh, Adam Clayton Powell.
Adam Clayton Powell's father, who started the Abyssinian Church. They had their own pro-social program to feed black folks during the Depression.
They did.
But, you know, if you don't know your history, you don't know that. Father Divine fed more people than the federal government, really. So now, the thing is, this thing about black folks always wanting a handout. You know, some people just read what white folks write, and they just go with it without doing their own research. Now, this thing about civil rights, you benefited from civil rights. Now, whether you,
I agree,
in these later times,
now,
you
like
want to criticize.
I also add on, like I say, the if we go back, because I go by 1865, because like I said, there's a part of the civil rights movement where black folks, black entrepreneurs, and then the freedmen's towns, blacks building their own towns, I consider that all part of the civil rights movement.
Well, I consider that self-help, pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps when you don't have boots.
Yeah,
but
and,
now
and,
the
and
thing
that,
is,
I that point.
And here's the thing, all of that stuff.
Nobody gave
me
anything.
Well, you look at it this way: when black folks was released from slavery, the only thing they had was the clothes on their backs. They didn't do anything for them. Now the Freedmen Bureau did do some things, but the Freedmen Bureau only lasted what, about 3 or 4 or 5 years? You're talking about people that have been enslaved. Huh?
No, it didn't last long. But hold it now. You got to remember, the black folk that did, because there were some blacks that did well after slavery was abolished because they had a remarkable skill. You had blacksmiths, you had tailors, you had carpenters.
Of course.
You had farmers. So those people weren't starving.
They were to a point. Now they had to build a foundation for themselves. Yeah, they had the skills, but they didn't have the land. And the thing is, you're talking about 40 acres and a mule. White immigrants came over here before 1865, and they were given 160 acres of land. All they had to do was just get here. So what black folks did right from dirt, they had to go in and they had to put their monies together to go in and get the land so that they could exercise their skills. Now, the thing is, those that had marketable skills in towns and things, yeah, they were able to go in and create businesses and things like that. And you have to look at the time.
Right.
We can't judge today on yesterday. Now, let me give you this. There's a whole lot of black folks in this era that is doing well, but the vast majority of black folk are not doing very well. But if you just pick out Oprah Winfrey and LeBron James and Eddie Murphy and all that, yeah, they're doing great. And if somebody writes their story the way we've been reading it, we can say black folks did real good in the 2000s, in the 1990s. But for the vast majority of the population, we're not doing well as a group, as you say, a wolf pack. So with that being the case, we got to be very careful about how history is written without us doing the research. Now, you and Pianchi, and I'm going to call his name out if he's out there, the first thing you see says, well, slaves got paid when they was in slavery. But what was the percentage? It was a very, very small percentage of slaves that was getting paid. And I think when the slaves were freed, I guess it was about 10% black folks that was freed. And all of them weren't successful business people. So with that being the case, we got to be very careful about how we put information out there. Now, look, this thing about civil rights, the last part of what you read about civil rights, I don't know if you understood what you read or not, but the thing is, it said that, I forgot what the definition was, but all civil rights was for America to live up to its creed about being a democracy. When I was drafted into the Army, my grandmama couldn't vote. Now, the laws was on the books, but they weren't enforcing it. She had to go in and fight intimidation and terrorism in order to vote. And back in that day, if you worked on a farm or you worked for a white fellow, the first thing he'd tell you is say, look, if you go with that civil rights stuff, then don't come back here. And if you was a tenant farmer, he would tell you, say, look, if you're going to vote, don't come back to my house. So back in that day, America wasn't a democracy. Medgar Evers was a war veteran, and he was protesting for the right to vote, and they killed him. But the thing is, we don't look at that.
We always look at
the way things are now. But back in the 50s and 60s, and you're too young to have experienced it. Now, I saw some of it. Hell, if a white guy was walking down the street and you was walking down the street, you had to get off the street and let them go by. Now, that wasn't, in the law books. But the thing is, you might as well say that was neo-slavery after 1865.
That's the way it was,
though. Well, but the way you're phrasing it.
Right.
Like, people that didn't do for self or wasn't able to do for self, they were beggars. They were looking for handouts, And the thing is, do you have black towns in spite of all of this? You have black folks succeeding in spite of all of this. Now, you say you're on the right side of civil rights. You're on both sides of the civil rights without even knowing it. Now, when you were at the West Texas State, was that a white college?
Yeah, the right.
Was West Texas State?
No doubt. No doubt. it was overwhelming. It still is.
But now, in the 50s, they wouldn't have had you go to that. But in the 50s and 60s, they wouldn't allow you to go to that school.
Well, that's true.
Civil rights made it possible for you to go to that school on a scholarship. Do you deny that?
I admit it. And I exercise my civil rights to go.
No. People fought for your right to exercise your civil rights to go.
I'm not denying that now.
Okay. But now that was all over the country. When you see black kids going to these white universities now, I'm talking about state-run universities. I don't give a crap about privately run universities like Duke. Black folks couldn't go to those schools. Now, when black folks do go to those schools, most of the time they're athletes. Very few go over on an open scholarship. Some of them do, but they're mostly looking for black talent on those sports teams. But the thing is, you wouldn't have been able to go to the – do you vote?
Yep.
Okay. In the 50s and 60s, now you're in D.C., but down here in North Carolina and in these southern states, you had to be very, very careful about trying to vote in these states. In fact, there's a story in Florida where a black man went to vote. And they ran his behind out of town. If they didn't kill him, I'll send you the link. But the thing is, when people were marching for civil rights, well, when they were marching for civil rights, they were marching for the right to exist in this country as citizens and to have all the rights of the citizens. So when you criticize Martin Luther King and Jesse Jackson and all of them, I mean, yeah, there's some things I don't like about those people. But the thing is, say what? I didn't understand.
I said they were just sitting on the left fence. I said Jesse Jackson, Martin Luther King, all those guys, Mayor Evers, they're sitting on the left-hand side of the table. Now, I said, and that's where you want to sit, that's fine. However, people like Frederick Douglass's son and his wife, they sat on the right side of the table, and they bought their own 40. They bought 40 acres and established their own town. So my preference is the right hand side of the table instead of the left hand side. I'm not saying that.
But you used the left hand side.
Well,
of the
I
table.
Mean,
you benefited
yeah,
from.
Yeah, I have.
And the thing is,
I
you
have
both. It's neither either or. You all is all incompetent. All of it worked together for
I'm
the betterment of the
world. If I had to say, but if I had to pick one side exclusively, it would be the right hand side.
But you didn't pick both. You didn't pick one side. You used both sides. You didn't pick one side. If you had been on the right side of the table, you would have went to HBCU. Or either you wouldn't vote and use the privileges that gained on the left-hand side of the table.
Now,
you can go anywhere.
I was born on a campus of HBCU. I was born at Freedman's Hospital. That's in D.C. That is now Freedman Square because now they moved the hospital around the corner on Georgia Avenue, which is now called Howard University Hospital. But originally it was Freedman's Hospital, which was on the campus of Howard University. And now that building is used for, I guess, the School of Communications and classrooms.
I got that. But all I'm telling you is
I was born on
that,
the campus of HBCU.
Right, but it took both sides to make a whole. Yeah, you had the entrepreneurs doing what they needed to do to try and get the benefits of the economic side. But on the social side, you had to have the protests of the civil rights movement to make sure that you could enjoy all of these things as an American citizen. You know, you couldn't vote back in that day without intimidation.
Well,
or you
let's take a look at. All right, I'm not disputing you, but let's take a look at. All right, Elijah Muhammad when he was alive, and the Nation of Islam. Now I would say, his approach to civil rights was on the right hand side of the table. His whole thing was do for self.
But I'm saying it takes both sides to make a whole. Yes. But the thing is, in order for Elijah Muhammad to travel as a black man in this country, it took civil rights to give him access to transportation to get to and fro and do what the hell he wanted to do. Yeah, you're right.
That's created, true.
But outside of his little comfort zone there in Chicago, the thing is, he was restricted by the laws outside of that city. Yeah, in the North, you have some measure of civil rights, but in the South, you didn't have any at all. So now, the thing is, people in their lives for your right to travel to and fro without going ahead on and somebody spitting on you or calling you a nigger ever, what have you. You can sit anywhere on the bus you want to now. But back then you couldn't do it. You know, and look, I'm going to tell you this shit. Black folks had their own bus lines. But the thing is, once you stepped outside of that bus and walked downtown, hey, you was in a hostile environment until these people sacrificed and what's his name, John Lewis and all of them, took them licks upside the head to where now you can go anywhere you want to without being harassed or either called a nigger. So it took both sides. You can't do either or if you black. You do both and. And that's the thing that, you know, I have a problem with black folks. We're living in modern times like this always existed the way it is now. And even now you have some problems. But back in the day, you couldn't do that.
That's true.
So now, you know, this thing, yeah, you talk about being on the right side, but hell, you couldn't be on the right side back in that day. You were a nigger, regardless of whether you had your own or whether you didn't. Whether you had your own, and look, you had a whole list of black districts in every big city until they ran these freeways through them. But once you stepped outside the black net, and sometimes in black neighborhoods, you were terrorized. Now they got black folks terrorizing their own. But all I'm telling you is that you got to look at things from that era before you pass judgment. Hell, when you went down to Southwest Texas, hell, you don't know if you were called a nigger or not, but you wouldn't have gone down there in the 60s. They wouldn't have had you down there. I don't give a damn how good a basketball player you were.
Yeah, the only, no, I didn't have no race problems because I went to that life was 70s, mid 70s, but mid to late 70s. But now, I remember in second grade, I was at my aunt and uncle's house in New Orleans. Now, this is the only blatant racism I've witnessed or been, experienced. It was a Sunday night, and we were in the back. In a rec room in a house in New Orleans, watching probably Ed Sullivan or something like that, and we heard a crash in the front of the house. You know, windows being broke. So my uncle went to the front of the house, and somebody threw a brick through the front window. Nigga, get out. So. The next day I went to my house. I didn't feel, safe in that house. About a couple of weeks later I went back, but anyway. So they didn't move out of that neighborhood. And of course I wasn't aware that they were the first blacks. There were two blacks that had college degrees. She had a PhD from Columbia, Ivy League. She was a music teacher in the New Orleans public school system. But I didn't know it until years later that they were the first black folk to move in this particular all-white neighborhood in New Orleans, Louisiana, which is deep south.
And me personally, I probably would have moved, but they didn't. They moved. They stayed there. The white folks moved out, and black folks replaced them. But you can never tell. It was just a nice, clean, squared away neighborhood, no matter who lived in it, black or white. But that's the only in-your-face moment of racism that I've personally experienced.
That was terrorism. There's a difference between racism and terrorism. But now look, we talk about Emmett Till getting killed, right? There were thousands of Emmett Tills that got killed back in the 50s and 60s. All you had to do was disagree with a white fellow in the field that you worked in, and you come up missing the next day. But see, that wasn't advertised. The only reason Emmett Till made a difference was because his mother said, no, I'm going to open this casket to show what white black folks go through down here, down south, and in this country. But there's records of thousands of Emmett Tills that, hey, look, you bucked up against a white fella. And the thing is...
Yeah, my grandmother used to say that. She said if the Mississippi River could talk, I forgot how she put it, but she... I'm a grandmother because my grandmother said what you're saying.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people in the Mississippi River that we don't know about.
And other states, too. But now here's the thing. The Civil Rights Marches gave you the freedom to move around in this country almost free of any type of situation. Now, there are some pockets. But the thing is, for you to say, hey, look, I want to be on the right side or the left side, no, hell no. You benefited from both sides. And the thing is, if it hadn't have been for people out there marching and getting their head hit and getting killed and every damn thing else, you wouldn't be able to get on a plane and go everywhere the hell you want to now and people don't look at you or either call you a damn nigga. You can't do that. So in order for you to say, hey, no, I'm on the right side, no, you're on both sides. You're an entrepreneur, and plus you benefit from the social gains that the civil rights movement wanted you to enjoy.
Right.
But now the thing is, you got some people. You have some people with your kind of thinking. No, I ain't gonna never march out there with Martin Luther King. He shouldn't be out there. He should go ahead on and stay in his place. And they told Megan Evers that too. But when things changed and things got better, all of a sudden, all of them was marching. All of them was enjoying all of the sacrifices that those people made. So the thing is, that's the only reason I call in. And look, you can have these other people come in here and say different.
Now, what do you think now? Let me ask you this. Megan Evers got assassinated on the front lawn of his house.
That's right.
Where his kids could see it. Now, his wife moved. I mean, I agree. She moved right after that happened.
She had to move. She had to move.
She had to protect those kids, yeah.
And herself, yeah. He was a troublemaker because he wanted America to live up to its ideals and creeds and the Constitution. And here's the other thing. You're forgetting that black men went off in World War I, World War II, the Spanish-American War, and the Korean War. When they come back, they couldn't enjoy some of the benefits that the white veterans enjoyed. They couldn't take it. Most of them couldn't take advantage of the VA benefits that was afforded to war veterans. In fact, some Vietnam veterans couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
So this thing about, you're talking about, hey, look, you want to be on the left side or the right side. No, hell no, you better be on both sides. If it takes marching, you probably need to march. And if you can find a piece of land and put up a business, you probably need to put up a business. You got to do both. Now, we have relied on these social issues more, but the thing is,
right,
you need to be on both sides in order for black folks to make it. In fact, I'll put it this way. The last part of that definition that you read for civil rights is nothing more than a political action committee. Only thing, we weren't organized in an institution. We had to march the streets to get some of these rights. But anyway, let your boy come in.
What you're saying makes sense.
Well, it should. I mean, it shouldn't even be a matter of, it shouldn't even be a matter of discussion or debate. We should be proud of every achievement that black folks have been able to accomplish in this country. Not just one side, but all sides. Because we've done it under duress, and we're still doing it under duress.
And see, that's why I mentioned the right-hand side of it, with the examples on the right-hand side, because I think we don't mention enough, or in many cases don't even mention at all, the black entrepreneurs, the black township owners. You know, you don't hear discussions about that too often.
But whose fault is that?
That's a very good question.
Well, I said it because I know the answer. I want to see if you know the answer.
Because the public school curriculum, that's decided by, that's very political. You know, if the,
it's
you know, if you have book cartels. Well, what, the school board? Or the PTA?
Which is dominated by?
Well, that's what I like. Well, it depends on where that school board is.
Well, let me put it to you this way.
Now, let's take Baltimore City. Baltimore City, I imagine the majority of their school board, they might have some white folks, because D.C. abolished their school board. Well, I imagine Baltimore City School Board is majority black and has been so for several decades. But for some reason, they're not talking about anybody. They're not talking about any black people on the right side of the civil rights table.
Have you ever heard of Governor
DeSantis? Yep, here right here in Florida.
Right. He said that black history, CRT or what the hell it is, shouldn't be taught in schools, didn't he?
He did.
What is it? Critical race theory?
What's it on? Critical race theory. Now, hold it now. Let's qualify that, because I think I got that audio of exactly what he said, because we want to take what he said in context.
Now, look,
uh-huh.
I'm in favor of him rejecting it because it had a homosexual component attached to
that
critical race.
That's the part he was talking about.
Right, but here's the thing, Brother L.A., he could have gone in and taken that out and still had that black history curriculum put in those schools. Look, a politician can always take out what they want, can't they? And any bill, they can say, look, he didn't do that, though, did he? But all I'm telling you is this.
No.
The money controls what goes in those schools. And the thing is, the money in the state goes through the state government. If the state government said, I want all of my schools to have a black history course in my schools, they're going to do it. The local board can say over what the hell they want to. But the man he who has the gold rules. And the golden
rule. I think I got it here. Hold on a minute. Hold on. I think I might have DeSantis with me.
Have you heard about critical race theory? I'm guessing you probably have. It has already insinuated itself into many institutions and is making rapid progress into others. If it takes hold, it will completely change the very nature of America and the way you live. Critical race theory holds that the most important thing about you is your race. The color of your skin, that's who you are. Not your behavior, not your values, not your environment. Your race. In critical race theory, if you are a member of a minoritized racial group, their term, not mine, you are a victim of a system that is rigged against you, a system that doesn't want you to succeed. On the other hand, if your race is privileged, you're an exploiter, whether you intend to be or not. Critical race theory begins from the assumption that racism occurs in all interactions. To see how this works, consider this thought experiment. Imagine you own a shop and two customers enter at the same time, one white and one black. Who do you help first? If you help the black person first, critical race theory would say you did so because you don't trust black people to be left alone in your store. That's racist. If you help the white person first instead, critical race theory would say you did so because you think blacks are second-class citizens. That's racist too. That's critical race theory. It can find racism in anything, even if it has to read your mind to do it. Critical race theory is a uniquely American invention. Brewed up at Harvard Law School in the 70s, now part of the academic and media mainstream, it is also uniquely un-American because it rejects the core tenets of the American, classically liberal Judeo-Christian value system. It turns the bedrock American idea upside down. Here it is in the words of Richard Delgado and Gene Stefanchik, two leading proponents. Critical race theory questions the very foundations of the liberal order, including equality theory, legal reasoning, enlightenment rationalism, and the neutral principles of constitutional law. It does this because critical race theory proponents assume racism is present everywhere and always, and they look for it critically until they find it. And they always find it. It has to be there because that's how the imperial European powers and then America set things up. Here, as in all dangerous academic theories, there is a kernel of truth. Human beings were not preoccupied with race until the 16th century, when Europeans began to explore and then colonize other parts of the world. Drawing distinctions between the races reached its peak in the 19th century with the widespread use of slave labor in North and South America. No one denies this, but since then, the Western world, and most especially America, has spent a lot of time, money, and blood breaking free of its racist past. It's been a rocky road for sure, but great progress has been made. Critical race theory says all this progress is a mirage. Racism never died, never even faded a little bit. It just hid itself better. Critical race theory, therefore, is not a continuation of the civil rights movement. It is, in fact, a repudiation of it. To critical race theorists, Martin Luther King was both wrong and naive. White Americans can never judge blacks by the content of their character. They can only judge them, always unfavorably, consciously or unconsciously, by the color of their skin. Ironically, not since the Aryan obsession in Germany in the 1930s and 1940s, or South African apartheid in the second half of the 20th century, has the social movement been so obsessed with race. Critical race theory is then, in a very real sense, a counter-American revolution. But that's a positive, not a negative to those who subscribe to the theory. The American experiment was given a 400-year tryout, and it doesn't work. So let's scrap it. That's what they believe. Is that what you believe? I'm going to guess that most of you don't. So how do we stop critical race theory before it infects the brains of too many decent Americans, especially young people, and turns us into something we have never been and shouldn't ever want to be? The answer is simple. Refuse to accept it. Don't be intimidated by the heads I win, tails you lose logic of this self-destructive, America-hating, anti-reality idea. Don't be bullied into thinking that you're racist when you know you're not, or that you're a victim when you know you're not. Defend yourself while you still can. I'm James Lindsay, founder of New Discourses for Prager University. Thank you for watching this video.
State Governor Ron DeSantis is speaking at a press conference today. He addressed a recent rejection of an African-American studies course at Florida high school.
this course on Black history, what's one of the lessons about? Queer theory. Now, who would say that an important part of Black history is queer theory? That is somebody pushing an agenda on our kids. And so when you look to see they have stuff about intersectionality, abolishing prisons, that's a political agenda. And so that's the wrong side of the line for Florida standards. We believe in teaching kids facts and how to think, but we don't believe they should have an agenda imposed on them.
The governor goes on to say that he and his administration were outraged earlier this month after banning that AP course, arguing that it violates state law and, quote, lacks educational value.
Okay, there you go. Critical race theory and what DeSantis said about it.
Look, the first part of that, you can take that and deconstruct it. And the thing is, what that first guy said was shit, bullshit. That has nothing to do with teaching history in the classroom. Now, look, you know what my definition of racism is. Racism is going to always
exist.
Say what?
Oh, give your definition for the people who don't know your definition.
Racism is a one-word pseudonym for the self-preservation and survival of the fittest laws of nature. It means, look, I take care of what I need to take care of for my group first, and my survival depends on me doing what I need to do to create an economy for food, clothing, shelter, transportation, and health care. And self-preservation is selected, is a law of selection, whereas I go in and I create all of those things to support my existence as a group. It has nothing to do with prejudice or bigotry. It's a law of nature. And the only reason Black folks lose is because we don't practice those two laws. Every animal, every mammal.
Now, all right, now, what's the identity? Because you use this word. What's the identity of your group?
That depends on who the group is. If you're European, it's white. If you're Asian, it's Asian. China, Korea, Japan. If you're over in the Middle East, it's an Arab. Whatever, you're Muslim or either you're in one of those Middle Eastern countries. And when they come over here, you notice they separate themselves according to their identity. We Black folks try to mingle in with everybody, and we don't practice around, and we don't do anything around our identity. Like self-preservation.
Okay, now, all right, hold on now. Now, see, now you've identified a group, Black people. Now, if you go to a place like Nigeria, where they identify by tribe, y'all might say, no, I'm not Black, I'm Igbo, or whatever the tribes are over there, I don't know. But
that's right.
So what about that? Yo, you know what, with the Rwandan genocide, the Tutsi, and I forgot the name of another tribe, on a DNA level, they're the same people. But ethnically, they identify by, I forgot, Tutsi, I forgot the name of the group.
And
it, you know, 900, almost a million people killed in 90 days. So, that's why I'm asking, with your definition of racism, you would have to identify that. What group are we talking about?
Well, here's the deal, Brother L.A. You have dialects and differences in languages and customs and religions in Europe, don't you?
You do.
And the United States, don't you?
All throughout, yeah, as vast as the United States is. I mean, you got people that live in parts of Alaska, Eskimos.
Well, look,
they're their own little tribe.
Right, but you don't go that far. Let's stay in the continental United States. You have Polish.
Okay.
You have French. You have Italians.
Oh,
you have
Russian, Ukrainian.
You name it.
You have it's all here.
It's all here. But they identify as white folk, don't they?
According to the United States Census Bureau, yes.
And look, here's the thing. They support everything that benefits white folk. Now, they have their differences, but they benefit on everything that it takes to help white folks survive in this country. They can invest together. They can do everything together. In fact, they have different parts of the town, but when they get together in their city councils and everything else, they come together as one common group. Even though they're different ethnically and they have different customs and everything else. And most of the time, religion binds them together. But the thing is, you don't have a Southern white openly reject something that a white person wants in the North when it benefits the whole race. We do. And the thing is this, when you say the deal that happened in Rwanda, that's just like the Crips and Bloods over here. They're black, but they're killing each other. And sometimes it's inspired by white folks. In fact, that Rwanda deal was brought on by the CIA that exploited those differences. Now, all of them is black. Sometimes you have Tutsis and I think there were Hutus in the same family, under the same roof, same color, but they were killing each other. So when you look at it that way, yeah, white folks don't realize that their strength lies in their racial identity, regardless of where they are. Now, yeah, you have some fools say, well, I don't see myself as black. I'm a human being. Well, like if you break down the root of a human, it means, doesn't it? You're a black being, if you want to go that route. But the reason why black folks lose is because we can't come together as a wolf pack to help benefit each other. We use all those little differences to go in and pragmatize ourselves. And people take advantage of that. Because there's no way in the world that a city like Detroit that's 80% black has those Arabs controlling the whole city economy. It doesn't make sense. In fact,
my line open?
Yeah. Let Pianki, your line's open. Pianki, you got the floor.
How you doing, sir? Did you get my email?
I got it. You talking about the one on the ports? I got it there yesterday. I thought I sent your email back saying I got it.
Yeah, did you read that letter?
Not that one, but
with the port, you got the plan of the port.
Yeah, I got
did you
the
read
port.
The read the letter? It's in there. It's part of it.
Okay. Well, I'll do that. You got the floor.
I heard somebody talking about curriculum. Curriculum in the school district, especially in Missouri, and also down here in Louisiana, is super toxic. If you whatever the parents want it to be, it's written in the statutes. If parents don't want to talk about this, that's their business. If they do, that's their business. The thing about the state regulatory is that the kids can read, write, and do arithmetic at a level. And the reason why come blacks don't march in the same tune because they're different. They are not the same. And look at their facial structure. In my wife's tribe, all their facial structures, it's not all, but a lot of their facial structure is the same. Black is not identified. Black does not equate to kin.
Now we're talking about in what country, Priyanka?
What, the letter?
No. Well, this is Nigeria. I got the letter right now. But
read it.
No. Okay, you're talking about featured the Nigeria cabinet, Nigeria's Federal Executive Council.
Read it.
Has given approval. You're talking about this part of the letter for construction of a multi-purpose port.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Minister of the State for Transportation revealed that while briefing the State House correspondents at the end of the Wednesday's meeting of the council presided over by President Muhammadu Buhari. He added that the council also gave approvals for the expansion of the Snake Island Seaport in Lagos and the Burutu Port in the Delta State. According to the minister, the three projects will be carried out by private investors at no cost to the Nigerian government. He said today the Federal Ministry of Transportation presented before the Federal Executive Council under the chairmanship of Mr. President, and the memos are, for one, of the approval for the expansion and the development of the Snake Island Seaport in Lagos, in the Lagos State, through public-private partnership arrangement, PPP.
How much is they talking about
second,
money about?
Huh?
How much is the money about?
$974,885,203.66. That's the private investor money.
Right.
I'm not done. And we expect the investor will get $18 billion over a period of 45 years concession period. The federal government will have $5.23 billion, and the ICRC will get $94.9 million.
Now, on the cover of the port, whose name's up there?
Oh, wait a minute. Jesus, am I reading this right? Before I get to that, Priyanka, here's another figure. Total investment capital by the investors is $1,285,000,000, $5,808,000, and Jesus, man, that's a trillion dollars. All right, hold it now.
Look at my booklet and look at the names on it at the top. Come on down to the picture. And up to the picture.
Well, hold it. I got to find the picture first now.
It's on the same page.
I see your name. Oh, I see it. Let's see. Okay. Port of Ondo, State of Nigeria. Priyanka. How do you pronounce their last name correctly? Banko?
Priyanka Bankole.
Dr. Fiola. Yeah, and Dr. Fiola, I mean, Fola. I can't pronounce the last name, but it starts with a, well, you know what the name is.
That's Chief Fola.
That's
my business part.
That's at the top. Yeah, that's at the top of the proposal with the picture of the port.
45 years ago, out into my grandparents. See, here's the thing, L.A., all this stuff about white supremacy and all that bull crap, that's a bunch of mess. That is a bunch of mess. But you know what? I like people who subscribe to that. You know why? Because they put themselves out of competition, even if they could compete in the beginning. They put themselves out. They scared. But so, no, that was we got several projects we're doing. I still got to do some more. My friend Foley had sort of an accident. He tore a patellar tendon in his knee. But I tore two of them, one in each of mine, so he'd be all right.
Well, $1 trillion is beyond impressive.
The thing is, you got to know what you're doing. See, people talk, but they can't walk the walk. And then again, they don't have no repertoire. It's like the old saying when I say a slave did not build America, people say, yeah, it did. I say, how are you going to build something where you are that you didn't build where you came from? And that's one of the things that people ask, you know, what's your resume? And some people's reputation precedes them wherever they go. Of course, as you get older and get out of the game and start to mention, then some younger person, a better program that's implemented by a crew will come forth and do it. Take your place. It changes all the time. Like your percentage you're always talking about, which is good. You right. Let people know about them and that the potential there. Now, that's one thing. Now, for people to do it, that's a whole different thing. Yeah, like, let me ask you something. In modern time, where would we be without white? Where would we be without whites? Where would the world be? Every group at some point in time in history contributes to mankind. And right now, it's them.
I agree. Well, you know what? It all depends on what part of the world you're talking about. Because with that proposal that you sent,
don't give that to nobody else.
You know, people travel. I mean, there are people that travel. I mean, there are parts of the world people go to when there's no white people involved at all.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, but how did they get there?
Yeah.
Yeah, how did they get there? What mode of transportation?
True. Well, boats, trains, planes, buses.
There you go. It's the availability. It's the innovations that make things available that would not be immediately available at the time, in this time.
And the innovations, everybody has participated in some type of viable innovation.
At some point, yes.
Right.
Innovation, you know, one way
from everybody.
One way that you can see, look at your Nobel laureates. Black Americans have won it in peace and in literature. But when you get down to the physics, the physiology, which is the body, the chemistry, and other sciences, you don't see them there. Now, in disciplines of education, in mathematics, you see a lot of Nigeria. Nigeria is a great when it comes down to computational skills. But the one from the United States, you don't see them there. And it's a shame because the kids, every child that's born has an ineffability for something. You just got to know how to find it. And things should be based on merit, not on skin color. If you're going to base it on skin color, why not base it on skin tone? You got light. And this is where the confusion comes in. You got dark. You got brown. You got tans. Yellow blacks. Nappy head blacks. Straight hair blacks. All this stuff is a bunch of... That's peculiar to the United States, by the way.
True. Well, any closing statements, Bianca?
So if I could go out and put up multi-story office buildings that pierce the skies above, bridges across waterways, highways, go into industrial plants of Ford, Chrysler, and Chevrolet, into the energy-producing plants of Anheuser-Busch. I've done that because of merit, not skin color. Although about 95% of my work crew was white males, they didn't have to work for me. They did because of the reputation. But anyway.
Well, that's what it comes down to. Who can do the
where's
job?
Your boy? Where's your boy at? You can let him comment on that if you want to. Let him come on in there and comment on it. You ought to be stopped and served.
All mics are open.
Yeah.
All mics are open.
Out of respect, I didn't say anything. But I do want to start off with this. Congratulations on your accomplishment. I've always given you that credit. But you don't give our people credit, because the thing is, the same way you say you built skyscrapers to pierce the sky, our ancestors in slavery did the same thing for free. And because they did it for free, it afforded you the opportunity to live the American dream. Now, you can deny it if you want to. Now, this thing about local school boards can determine whatever they want to in a curriculum. Yes, they can, but Governor DeSantis said that, hey, I don't want critical race theory in my state schools. Money comes from the state. Yeah, you can suggest, and the textbooks are approved by the state. And the thing is, if a governor doesn't want it, then it doesn't come in that school.
Well, Textbooks approved by the local people. When time comes for, when that period of time when it comes for a school district to switch from one social study book to another, the publishers are giving notice to those that want to participate and showing what they have. You can come display your books here in room such and such or in the school cafeteria, and they will put on display. And then there are cards that those who come and display, whether it's from the public or as teachers, they can write a memo, check off on the card what they approve of, what they don't like of this particular publication. That's how it goes down in the school district that I am very, very familiar with. Let me finish something because you said a lot of things. Slaves did not build America. They participated in the workforce. And can say that they didn't get paid is not true, because Dunn and Bradstreet kept very good records of the businesses that blacks, quote-unquote, had from 1600 through 1865. And they had businesses, and they got paid. Common sense with the old notion that blacks worked and bought their ancestors out of slavery, they did. They do that in many ethnic groups around the country, around the world, it is. Matter of fact, the whole thing about pawn, P-A-W, like the pawn shop, is when you owe, if I owe L.A., and I say, L.A., look, I ain't got the money to pay you, but here, take my grandson and work him, and we'll work it off like that. That's how that works. Go ahead.
And that was a common practice, even going back to biblical days.
Absolutely.
Exactly. But now, it wasn't a thing where you kept a person in perpetual slavery unless they said that they wanted that to happen. Now, going back to what he said about the school district, Governor DeSantis said that I don't want anything in my state. I don't want that curriculum in my state. Now, the school board didn't say, well, I want it over here in Broward County, or I want it over here in another county. He said that it's not going to go there, and that's the way it went. Now, the other thing is...
Right there.
But did you hear me say?
Yeah, you said. Let's talk about what you said he said. Let's look at that. He has no control over private school district. Private can do whatever they want to, just like if parents don't want their children to be influenced with it, they can't do it. And another point, just like Howard University told their middle school that was designed in order to feed black kids and get them prepared from high school so they can feed into Howard, they too told that middle school you cannot have this African, this black history course in this school. Go ahead, sir.
You said private. Governor DeSantis decides what goes on in public schools, where the majority of black
people don't decide. I'm not going to argue that.
Now, the thing is this. He said, I don't want it in the public school system, and they don't have it. And I agree with him. But now the thing is, ever who appropriates the money does have a decision on what goes on in those schools, regardless of what school districts they're in. Now, that's just a matter of common sense. Well,
you know, on that, L.A., I've shown you documentation, stories, in St. Louis Post-Dispatch where it shows you where black school districts, you might as well say black, they're 99% black, they have more money per child than their counterparts that are quote-unquote white school districts.
I remember reading that. You said that thing. I remember reading that.
More money. And I know the buildings are good because I built about 11 schools in the St. Louis area. Rashawn being my last, the school namesake that Maxine Waters attended when she stayed in St. Louis. So, no, it's the parents' decision of what direction that their child is educated. That's what the statute in Missouri says. That the curriculum, textbooks, and teacher's instruction shall be whatever the local district wants it to be, and that the State Board of Education and the Department of Education cannot mandate to a school district. In other words, that's what the law says.
So you're saying what Governor DeSantis is doing is illegal?
In the material that he described, it ain't illegal.
He said, hey, look, I'm rejecting this for the state schools. So what he's doing is illegal, according to you.
No, it's not what he's doing.
Wasn't that in relationship to the homos, the gay agenda content? Wasn't he referring to that specifically?
Right. That's absolutely right.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong now. Don't get it twisted. He said, I don't want it in my state, and he rejected it. Now, the thing is, like I said earlier, if he really wanted that, he could go in and say, well, I will have it in here if you take out that queer part of the curriculum. He didn't do that. But getting back to where the argument is here, or the discussion is here, is that the governor can't have any say-so over local school boards. Now, in Florida, he did. Now, I don't know about Missouri. But in Florida, he said, no, it's not going to go in these state schools, public schools.
Well, let me say this. You got parent groups and ethnic groups like Asians. You got blacks. Say they don't want their children to be exposed to it. So if they had the books in the classroom and the parents say, I don't want my child to be exposed to this, so when it comes time to this subject, my child is going to stand in the hallway. Or if you got a teacher of that persuasion, my child is not going to be in that class. This has been done. I've seen this before.
Well,
so
look,
ultimately, the parents have the power. Parents, Asians, they march down the street with big banners. We don't want no critical race theory for our kids.
That has nothing to do with black history being taught in schools. But let me give you this. There's such a thing as mandatory.
Black parents did it too, by the way.
Listen, there's such a thing as mandatory courses and electives. Now, the thing is, if you don't want your child to learn about a certain subject, good. Make it an elective. That way, anyone that wants to go in there voluntarily can. That's not what is being said here. And my thing is this here. I'm going to go back because there's a lot of things being tossed around here. You never give the percentage of how many blacks doing slavery was in business. and had their own thing. Now, there is a study, and there's a book that goes through that same list that shows that black folks that did work on building this Washington, D.C., were subcontracted out by their white owners, and they were given a certain portion of what they earned. Now, the thing is, you never give a percentage of how many blacks was being paid back in slavery days. Because if you did...
Well, let me say this. On that point, I've heard people say there were none of them paid. Haven't you, L.A.?
Yeah,
I have
most
heard.
People believe that they were not paid at all.
I've heard people say that they didn't get paid today.
But many of them got paid.
How
Absolutely.
Many? What was the percentage?
No one knows how many.
That's right, because the thing is that this. I'm going to give you this. The vast majority of blacks during slavery time was in the fields working, and they weren't getting paid. And it was very few free blacks marching around in this country during that time. So now, when a person throw that out there, it needs to be a part that says, yes, some slaves did get paid. But the thing is, they put out the illusion that a whole lot of black folks were just walking around getting paid in slavery. That wasn't true. And that's where I differ.
All right, let me address that. Because what you're saying is deceptive. Nobody knows what contractual agreement or what type of handshake agreement that these people existed under. That's impossible to know. It's impossible. But what is known is they got a big book with company people's names and the adventure that they engaged themselves in. That's very, very, very disingenuous to say that blacks did not have the ability to start a business. They had businesses that you don't see people today. I ain't saying that it's you. They're saying that. I wouldn't expect you to go out and build a multi-story building. Nor would you expect me to go out and start a corner grocery store, but
you know,
I don't want to.
Beasley, even in 2023, with the internet and everything, and people got the electronics, there's only a small amount of a group of blacks that have started businesses.
Exactly.
And that's in 2023.
You just validated my point. You validated my point. Even back then,
LA.
You validate my point. Even back then, it would be more difficult. But the thing is, if there's a book that was written that details how many blacks was being paid to build the capital of D.C. and how many that weren't. Now, the book that, now, if you deny the book, now I can go with Bradstreet and Everhood Dunn and Bradstreet, but it should have a figure of how many was getting paid and how many not. I go by facts. Yeah, some people probably did get paid.
One figure that I know that's documented is there were over 4,000 free blacks that were plantation owners.
Right. Now, that's a
figure. When they went over and started a Liberia, I mean, it wasn't a whole gang of people, but it was enough for them to go over to Africa, buy land, and start the Nation of Liberia would still exist.
You know why?
And then the Republic of Maryland. And
it
never
would
be a whole gang of people for anything. Go ahead, Sparky.
Yeah, L.A., it wasn't a whole gang because people are not capable of doing that. Just like people are not capable. I mean, take this. What percentage of all the high schools and college black players make it to the NBA? Less than 1%.
Very good. Very good point, Pianchi. I know part of that answer. I know part of that. All right, from high school, I'm going to just use basketball. From high school to Division I basketball, it's less than 1%.
That's right.
Then you take the college pool, it's less than 1% from the college pool. So it's a very small, I mean, the NBA only has about 340 people. That's it.
450.
And also,
okay, 450,
the slaves have
a thousand to play.
Yes. Those blacks that worked on the Capitol, they was laborers. They didn't build, per se, like we talk about today. They participated in the labor activities, and some of them I know they didn't do because I can look at the equipment and tell you the skill that you need to operate that equipment. For instance, like the guy derricks and the steam engine power source for the guy derricks. When those slaves working those guy derricks, they weren't doing it. We use guy derrick. I used a guy derrick maybe several times in my life, and I showed you the 20-some-odd story building there on Brentwood Boulevard that we used the guy derrick for. We used them two buildings, one behind the other. Those complicated pieces of equipment to use, and wasn't nobody like that used that back in those times.
There's always going to be a small amount, particularly when it comes to entrepreneurship, which basically you got to be proactive. Most people want the comfort and convenience. Look, I'll do the work. Give me a paycheck every week or every 2 weeks, and I'm good. There's always going to be a small amount of the majority. Well, now let me take that back. Because during the early part of this country, a lot of people who were homesteaders, they had to build their own house with family and friends. They had to grow their own food. But I don't know all the numbers you're talking about, though. But
well, now, it's not going to be
an overwhelming majority of people.
You go back to the core of this discussion. I said the illusion was that a whole lot of black folks during slavery was getting paid, and they weren't. And you validated my point, and Bianca did too, by saying that, you know what, you use the sports industry in this country to validate my point. There's a whole lot of people out there, but only a few get in.
How do you know?
Hold it. Let me finish. And the thing is, it was a small percentage of slaves getting paid.
All right, you said that three times. Let's stop right there. I'm going to let you go on.
I'm reclaiming my time. And I said, yeah, a few did go through the safety net. And look, the people that did have plantations, most of them bought their own families. When you started off in this program, bought their families to make sure that if they got stopped by slave catchers, they had papers to prove that, hey, look, so-and-so owned me, and it was a family member, a husband, and what have you. But there weren't a lot of slaves being paid in this chattel slavery system.
Let me comment on that. See, you want to tell a story rather than work on your point. Mulattoes wasn't buying those dark-skinned blacks. They weren't doing it. I mean, common sense to tell you that. People of a skin kind, they weren't buying no dark-skinned blacks. Also, they did. You don't know who all got paid. Because even where the continent that taught the rest of the world slavery, their slaves do get paid. This word slave is used disparaging here in the United States compared of its reality in other parts of the world.
That word
slave in Africa.
Wait, gentlemen, we got to end up because we're way over time. And before Blog Talk drops us off, so everybody have a good rest of the day.